Here in the United States, mortgage rates are at record lows, but many homeowners cannot seem to take advantage. NPR's Wendy Kaufman looks at why.
Pennsylvania resident Jeff Marsico has been with the same lender for 15 years. He's had two houses and never missed a payment. With equity in his house, a solid income and credit score, he figured refinancing with his existing lender would be fairly simple. It wasn't.
This has been a very painful process.
It took 90 days to get the loan, and along the way, the lender inundated him with requests for documents, every single page, even the blank ones, of his brokerage account statements, and every page and schedule of his two most recent tax returns.
Many of you who use accountants probably know that the accountant staples the top of the tax returns. So in order for me to scan those documents, I was like pressing the paper up against the scanner, and it left a black mark at the top.
It wasn't pristine enough for the lender, who wanted blotch-free pages. So Marsico undid the staples and re-scanned the pages.
That was frustrating.
There were lots of other frustrations, too. But in the end, he got a new loan. It's less than 4.5%, and he'll save about $1,000 a year. But not everyone will be so fortunate. The days of easy-to-get mortgages are over.
Prior to the credit crunch, if you had a pulse, you got a loan.
But today, says Greg McBride, a senior financial analyst at Bankrate.com, many homeowners cannot refinance. They don't have enough equity, their incomes are too low, their debt too high, or their credit scores aren't good enough. FICO scores, the ones used by nearly all the big lenders, range between 300 and 850. Right now, you need a score of 740 or even higher to get the best rate. 3 years ago, a score in the 700 range might have sufficed. Similarly, says McBride, the cutoff to get any loan is substantially higher today than it used to be.
Now, if your credit score is much below 660, 680, it's going to be tougher to get credit, and it's going to be tougher to find attractive terms. You get below 620, and then it becomes really tough sledding.
About a third of the population falls into those lower categories. Again, Greg McBride.
Lenders are still pretty skittish because of the high level of mortgage defaults, and borrowers have to bring more to the table than a smiling face.
Seattle area mortgage originator Rhonda Porter sees all kinds of credit scores, and the ones she sees may differ slightly from those a consumer sees. She explains that credit scores provided to mortgage lenders are tweaked slightly from those provided to, say, auto dealers or credit card companies.
People are often surprised, like they might think they have a 740 score, but when I see the report, maybe it's 720. The other thing, too, that kind of goes into this is what lenders look at is the middle credit score.
Mortgage originators and lenders, says Porter, look at the scores from all three of the major credit reporting agencies.
So if you have a 740, a 680, and a 710, it's going to be the 710.
Something as seemingly insignificant as a $550 balance rather than a $500 balance on a credit card could hurt your score. And says Porter,
credit scoring, I mean, it's not an exact science, and yet people are really judged heavily by it.
Higher credit scores, more equity, and higher income to debt ratios. The Mortgage Bankers Association suggests that all of that is here to stay. And what about the low rates? The association believes that rates will rise to just over 5% next year and up to 5.5% in 2012. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
The president is now in South Korea for a summit of the most important world economies. As the G20 leaders meet, one source of growing friction is trade, another the manipulation of currencies. NPR's Jim Zaroli says recent moves affecting the dollar have only worsened tensions.
The countries gathering in Seoul tonight for the G20 summit can pretty much be put in two camps. There are older, slow-growing economies like the United States, Japan, or much of Europe. And there are red-hot emerging countries like Brazil, China, and India that regularly rack up huge trade surpluses. U.S. officials have long complained that relations among world economies are severely unbalanced. They say China, in particular, has kept its currency artificially low to make sure its exports are cheap. Here was President Obama in Indonesia yesterday.
You're seeing some countries run up very big surpluses and intervening significantly in the currency markets to maintain their advantage when it comes to their currency. We've got other countries that are in deficit.
These days, most countries acknowledge there are imbalances that must be corrected. But some world leaders say steps taken lately by the U.S. to stimulate growth may be making the world's problems worse. Economist Iswar Prasad of Cornell University says the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department have poured huge amounts of money into the U.S. economy, and it hasn't had the desired effect.
The problem is that the U.S. is flooding its economy with money, and demand is not quite picking up. So the result is that a lot of this money is flowing to other countries.
Prasad says right now in the U.S., money is incredibly cheap. As a result, it's easy for investors to borrow dollars and invest them in fast-growing economies like Thailand and India. In some places, this has helped push up the inflation rate, and governments like Thailand have imposed capital controls to keep too much money from flowing into the country.
If you have amounts in the order of $10 to $20 billion flooding into an economy like Thailand over a period of 2 to 3 months, that sends the Thai stock market and Thai inflation rates surging.
So Prasad says a lot of countries believe the U.S. is doing much more harm than good.
There is a very strong sense that the U.S. could end up not doing very much good for itself, probably create some risks for itself, but more importantly, create huge risks for the rest of the world. And there is a sense that the U.S. has blinkers on it about the effects of its policies on the rest of the world.
And the unhappiness toward the U.S. has only grown in the wake of the Fed's decision last week to pursue a new round of quantitative easing. That is, the Fed is buying up Treasury bonds as a way of pouring even more money into the economy. U.S. officials say the moves are necessary to keep the economy from slipping back into recession and to bring the high unemployment rate down. But the moves were roundly criticized by China, Germany, and Brazil. As the G20 countries gather in Seoul, there is likely to be plenty of behind-the-scenes finger-pointing and recriminations. Karsten Breske, senior economist at ING, says these differences aren't going to be ironed out overnight.
Will we really get a solution for this imbalance problems now at the G20 meeting? No, we won't. But we will get a lip service and some verbal commitment that at least all the big global players are aware of the problem.
Breske says countries are unlikely to come away from the summit with any hard targets for fixing currency rates or narrowing trade gaps. But there is a slowly building consensus that the global economic order has to change, and that the days when countries like China and India could grow rich, running huge trade surpluses with the United States, won't last forever. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
Britain is taking action to boost its trade ties with China. Prime Minister David Cameron has just led his country's biggest official delegation to the Middle Kingdom in 2 centuries. Vicky Barker filed this report from London.
David Cameron was leaving China with several deals already in the bag. Among them, a $1.2 billion contract for Rolls-Royce aviation engines and an agreement that only genuine Scottish whiskey can be marketed in the country as Scotch. That's seen as guaranteeing tens of millions for Scottish distillers. But Cameron avoided public reference to political reform until his final speech to students at Beijing University. There, he extolled the virtues of Britain's parliamentary democracy, where the opposition party has a constitutional obligation to hold the government to account, and where a free media tries to do the same. Opening up its own society, Cameron suggested, is in China's best economic interest.
Because I'm convinced that the best guarantor of prosperity and stability is for economic and political progress to go in step together.
At the moment, Germany accounts for about half of Europe's exports into China, and Britain's finance minister, George Osborne, says Britain would like a bigger piece of the action.
As we now have a Chinese middle class emerging, they're going to start to want, I think, British services, British higher-value manufactured products.
So far, though, Chinese consumers are buying such high-end German products as Mercedes and BMWs. New figures show Britain is emerging from the global downturn more slowly than Germany or Japan. Analysts say that's largely because it's failed to seize the trade opportunities posed by China's economic resurgence. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. President Obama arrived in Seoul, South Korea today for the G20 summit, which begins tomorrow. The president has spent the past several days touring Asia with stops in Indonesia and India. For South Korea, the chance to host President Obama and the rest of the G20 presents an enormous opportunity in terms of policy and perception. NPR's Louisa Lim reports from Seoul.
As President Obama touched down in Seoul, South Korean news channels covered his arrival live. This is a defining moment for the country, which has spent millions preparing for the G20.
It's in a sense a coming out for Korea.
Choi Soo-chan is a professor at KAIST, Korea's answer to MIT. He says for South Korea, being the host and chair of the G20 meeting has deeper significance.
The fact that Korea, which has regarded itself as a sort of weak nation, has become a sort of middle ground nation, and now it can claim itself to be part of this expanded leadership.
South Korea is taking no chances. Some 50,000 police are patrolling the streets, but big demonstrations are planned for tomorrow. Some protests are already underway. Here, a few dozen activists rally. They're showing their opposition to a free trade agreement between South Korea and the U.S. It's a deal negotiators are still hoping to clinch before President Obama meets his South Korean counterpart, Lee Myung-bak, tomorrow. It's been held up by disputes over South Korea's treatment of American autos and beef. Now, the South Korean press is hinting a compromise may have been reached. Protester Hwang Hyung-jun says he believes any FTA will benefit big business, not ordinary people.
So you cannot believe the Korean government. I think they will give too much to the U.S. government. That's not fair to Korean people.
So if a deal is reached, it could ignite more fury on the streets. But if it isn't, U.S. businesses could suffer, according to Tammy Overby, vice president for Asia of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
The free trade agreement, really, it is about economics, but it's also about the American footprint in Asia. The rest of the world has not been standing still, so America has got to get in the game.
Next on the agenda, another tricky bilateral, this time with China's president, Hu Jintao. The relationship has spiraled, with disputes over trade, territorial issues, Tibet and Taiwan, among other things. International relations professor Jin Tan Rong from People's University in Beijing says China's been taken aback by the storms overshadowing the two powers.
The climate change from clear sky to raining is beyond the expectation of Chinese side. We don't know what's going wrong. My personal expectation is that after this summit, the free fall of U.S.-China relations will stop.
Let's go, let's go, let's go.
After that bilateral summit, the opening of the G20 itself, which even has its own theme song. This normally stodgy economic meeting could prove surprisingly exciting this year. In the run-up, officials from Brazil and Germany lashed out at the U.S. policy of quantitative easing, calling it clueless and akin to throwing money from a helicopter. China, too, was critical, perhaps spotting an opportunity to turn the focus away from its own currency. President Obama has responded by writing to the G20 leaders, arguing that a strong recovery in the U.S. would be its most important contribution to global recovery. For the president, this visit to a normally welcoming ally is looking increasingly contentious. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Seoul.